Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Jane Lindholm. All winter long, a raptor has been teasing me outside the windows of VPR, off in the distance, circling, swooping. I can almost bet it's a hawk, but it never got close enough for me to identify. Then, a couple of weeks ago, I'm in a conversation with a colleague when I rudely brush past him yelling, "It's a red-shouldered hawk! It's a red-shouldered hawk!" I could see it perched on a branch not far from our office. It was a clump of dried leaves holding on for dear life after our long winter. But what does that to us? What makes me marvel at how birds can fly at top speed through a thicket of trees and not clip a single branch? And I'm not even a birder, but I love seeing different types of birds and what they do. Well, if anyone can explain this crazy fascination about birds, it's the bird diva herself, Bridget Butler. And thankfully, she's back with us today, Bridget. Thanks for being here.
Oh my gosh, Rick, that was an awesome story. I was like totally on edge.
So true.
It really is. Like those clumps of things, you know, that you think is a bird, but it's not, like the trash bag or the grocery bag that I think is a snowy owl every winter.
And the wind just moves it in the right way.
Right?
And you think, there it is.
Yeah.
I'm seeing nothing.
Yeah, seeing something. That's your right side of the brain at work. And that's really a good thing, because really what that's telling you is that you know birds enough that that part of your brain is starting to tell you and cue you into the shapes and silhouettes and things to look for.
Oh, I like that.
So I think that's something to be excited about.
All right. I'm excited now. Do you have to be a serious birder to enjoy birds?
Oh, my gosh. No. You know, and I think this is like the heart of my work right now, is really trying to think about how to engage people at the level that they're at and as beginners. And one of the things that's really hard about birding is there are so many birds.
Yes.
And there are so many sounds out there. So you can get overwhelmed really quickly. And I think the other piece of it, too, is that the way that the birding culture or birding community has grown has been actually very left-brained. It's been that very analytical side of things in terms of identifying stuff by looking at plumage and getting the calls down and all of that. So it really kind of pushes aside folks that maybe use their right brain more to experience and learn things. So I've been trying to think about how do I put those two things together and kind of shift how we bring people into birding so that we can really kind of start to meet them where they're at.
Yeah, because it can be intimidating watching birds for non-bird watchers.
Yeah.
You go out with a group and you think, oh, they know everything and I know nothing. So what are good ways for us to enjoy it without knowing a ton about birds?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is just start right in your backyard, right? There is so much there. And if you're a feeder watcher, especially, now you have something that's bringing the birds in and bringing them close to you in a way that you can study them kind of over and over again. So one of the things that I suggest to people is like make a list of what your usual suspects are for your backyard. Who is going to be there on a regular basis? And then pick one of those birds to really get to know and get to know the way they look, the way they sound, and their behaviors as well. So if you take something like a black-capped chickadee, which is right black and white, that's good,
yep.
Right?
Good There's start.
Not, it's here all year round, right? It's not going to leave. The song is its name, or its call is its name. Its song is a little bit different, but it's easy to kind of to see that bird on a regular basis. And the more you expose yourself to watching that bird over and over again, you're going to create those patterns and things in your brain that your right and left brain are going to learn to work together to recognize. So start with something simple, like the birds that you have right out in your backyard, and focus on behavior and their shape and their size and things like that, and kind of build a little bird profile. That bird then becomes your foundation bird. So when people call, and we've done this on the show before, people call in and they're like, I saw a bird. It was brown. It was on the ground. And it was doing this. What is it? Well, one of the first questions I always like to ask is it bigger or smaller than a chickadee? So if chickadee is your starting reference point, it gives you a great place to kind of build on and off of.
And you could become like an expert on the brown bird that's always hanging in your backyard,
yeah,
too. Learn everything
super,
about that bird.
Everything about that. I often think that, you know, the traditional way that we think about birding is I find out what the name of the bird is, I learn the song, and I put a check mark next to that bird and I move on. Mm. But do you really know the bird?
Yeah.
Like one of the things I love to do with people is we all know American Robin, right?
Right.
Right. And they're showing up a little bit more in our yards as they kind of disperse across the landscape a little bit more during the springtime. But when I ask people to describe a robin to someone sitting next to them or try to say out loud what a robin looks like, it's all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, what does it really look like? Like, what color is the beak? And what color is the head? And where is the red? Does it stop all the way down the belly? So we don't really know that bird yet. If I asked you, what are some of the displays or the courtship behaviors of that bird? You'd be like, I don't know. But I bet you've already seen them.
Yeah.
You just don't know that that's what that is yet. Yet.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you talked about the backyard, and that question of bird feeders comes up. And Nancy in East Charleston wrote to us and said, please make me feel better about removing all our bird feeders. Mm. Up here in the kingdom, we still have snow cover, and our empty feeders are visited daily by our winter chickadees, woodpeckers, and blue jays. And now juncos, red-winged blackbirds, and sparrow-like birds are checking in on nothing there.
Yeah, right. It's April 1st.
Right.
And so, actually, we're past April 1st.
Yeah.
And that's the time that Vermont Fish and Wildlife and the Audubon Society recommend that you take your feeders in if you're in an area where there potentially could be bear. So black bear, unfortunately, when they wake up, they're super hungry and they're going to take advantage of whatever resources are there. And if it's our feeders, then we've brought them closer to people. And that's not healthy for the bear or for us. So that's the recommendation. And it's really hard to pull the feeders down because it's such a source of enjoyment and of study, too, as well. And then you're worried about, like Nancy is, about, gosh, what are they going to do now? But I think it's really fascinating to go out now and start noticing the shift. We have warmer temperatures. The creeks are flowing a little bit more. We have hatches of stoneflies happening. You're probably noticing ladybugs all over the place in different spots. So we are seeing this like shift from the winter food sources to spring food sources. And so there are more insects out there on the landscape. There are things like spiders and chrysalises and cocoons and things like that that are in this dormant state that are still really great to eat. So birds are relying on those. And we have to think about things like plants and shrubs. And this is the piece that I always like to tell people is, start focusing on what you can provide in your yard that you can grow. So things like sumac, dogwoods, viburnums, we know the crab apples hold on to their apples all year round. Those were like the hot spots for pine grosbeaks this year. Oh. Man, that was like my favorite thing was watching the pine grosbeaks every day. On the way to the bus stop, there was this great crab apple tree that they were feeding on. So as we shift away from our bird feeders and we have to, those of us who live in that area where there are bears, we can start thinking about gardening and landscaping in a different way to provide those foods, especially during this kind of shoulder season.
All right. And getting outside of our own backyard, I know you're doing something called birds and beers. Now, I know you're not serving up IPAs to juncos. So
no.
Is this a good way for someone who doesn't know a ton about birds?
Oh, my gosh. This is so good. So birds and beers is a monthly gathering. It's really informal and it's super social. And I've been holding them in different spots around the state. And the whole idea is to just build community and bring birders together and non-birders even. It's been so fun to show up at a brewery with a bunch of birders and then everybody else is like, who are you people? And slowly you're like, come over and tell me your bird story. So yeah, we get together, we have dinner together, we have a few drinks together. I kind of start to guide and facilitate conversation between different people. So last month we were at the Brewster River Pub and Brewery up in Jeffersonville. We had 16 people show up and we had two moms with their 12-year-old daughters come out. And I was able to introduce these two young birders to each other and say, look, there are other kids like you who are really into this. So it is. It's a great way if you're a beginner to come out and start to chat people up. We pull out our phones and share our sightings, right? So people were sharing barred owl photos. All kinds of really cool stuff has started to come out of it. And it's a way for groups that are in that area, like we had folks from the local conservation commission there say, this is what we're doing. You can come and be a part of that as well.
Fantastic. All right. We have tons of calls already. So let's talk to Mark, who's calling from Bakersfield. Mark, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My question is referring to downy woodpeckers that we have and also blue jays. I have a bird feeder and it has a long slot and have sunflower seeds in it. And they'll come up to feed and they'll sweep back and forth, scattering all the seeds on the ground. And I'm just wondering, what is their purpose? Because they'll sweep back and forth and then they'll finally take one and they'll go down and they'll open it up. And it doesn't, but we have all sorts of seeds on the ground right now.
Yeah. It's interesting how the different feeding behaviors at the feeder sometimes serve the purpose of other birds. So if you think of the sparrows that are coming in, that downy woodpecker or the blue jay that tend to be like messier feeders, they're actually spreading seed out for the other birds that don't tend to come up to those perches. So I think in part, this is the bird searching for the perfect seed, right? And I notice this when I get a bag of birdseed that might not be such great quality. You can see in some of the sunflowers, they're not as plump or as robust as other ones. And so this is one of the fun parts of having feeders close to you is to now you've noticed this general behavior. Now watch more specifically. Can you see the seed that the bird is picking and maybe get an idea? Is that bird kind of shuffling everything back and forth to get at the more plump seed? Is it that the snow? I think of like the snow cover that happened on my feeders. And I would have loved the downy woodpecker to come in and clear everything off of that snow cover so I didn't have to go out and do it. So it might be that as well. It was there moisture that like sat over the top of the seed and they're just like, yeah, I don't want that one.
Yeah.
Great observation though.
You mentioned barred owls and Carrie wrote to us, we had a barred owl fly into a window at 3 a.m. about 2 months ago. He flew in under a slight overhang. His impact was startling to us and I'm sure to him as well. I've been reading locally of the increase in barred owls and wondered if this type of behavior is typical of a young owl. He was stunned and laid in the snow for a few minutes, then flew off apparently unharmed, albeit with a headache.
Yeah, I bet. So yeah, this was a really interesting phenomenon this year. And, you know, if you're on Facebook, you probably saw it, or Twitter, tons of photos just coming into different streams of people having encounters with barred owls. So some of the folks that were commenting on this from the Vermont Institute of Natural Science and Vermont Center for Eco Studies, some folks down in Massachusetts, some of the thoughts were that there's actually a boost in the population of rodents. So white-footed mice, had a really good year, so lots of babies. And that subsequently meant that owls last year with young were able to catch more mice and more young birds survived of barred owls. So then now we go swing the opposite way and there's a lot of young barred owls that survived last year. We get an intense winter, snow cover, ice. I mean, think about trying to be a barred owl and like bust through not only deep snow, but then layers of ice to get at those rodents that are below the snow surface. And it's really tough. Young juvenile owls are the ones that get the worst territory because the more mature owls will push them out. So you see inexperienced birds coming to feeders to be able to try to survive because we have moles and voles that are picking up on the seed.
Mm-hmm.
The collision with the window could be a number of things, is just not experienced with buildings. The other thing, and we were going to talk about this too, is in terms of how our outdoor lights can affect birds. This is one of the ways. So if you have large picture windows or windows that aren't broken up in terms of like the panes on the window, a lot of times the reflection from outside, the reflection on the window looks like the outside. And so the bird can't tell that they can't fly through that.
Right.
So the owl goes in and thinks it has much more space than it really does and ends up colliding with the window.
Well, let's also talk about what that light does, because, you know, a lot of these migratory birds will fly in the evening.
Yeah.
Right? First of all, why do they do that?
Yeah, so this is really cool. So if you fly at night, there's a bunch of different things that you can take advantage of. And one of them is cooler air temperatures. And when you're, if you and I flap right now, yeah. And I'm flapping right now, Rick is not playing right. along. Okay, there he's playing along.
My bad shoulder.
So right, here's what's going to happen, right? Your bad shoulder, your body's going to start to heat up and all those muscles are going to start to heat up and you can't sustain flight that way. So the cooler air is going to cool your body down, keep your muscles cool so you'll be able to last longer. The pressure on the wings is also different. And then you have stars to navigate by. So they kind of use star maps, magnetic fields. They'll use the landscape, the geography, and weather. So all these things kind of come together and help the bird to be able to migrate during spring and fall migration. When we have lights on, that light interferes with their ability to use one of their tools, which is those star maps. And in large cities, this can be a really big problem. So light pollution, there's been some really cool research done. You've probably seen the photos online of like pictures at night across the United States, and those big, bright areas are where our large cities are. There's a recent study out that was done by Cornell, and it's just recently published in the Frontiers in Ecology and Environment, that really shows the top 10 cities for where these collisions are happening. So the thought is the light interferes with the bird's ability to migrate and to guide themselves. The bird then comes out of the sky and drops into these large urban landscapes where there's lots of glass. And so collisions tend to go up in those areas. So we have all of these birds migrating at night, and if we can start to turn lights out, even in these big urban centers, then we're going to keep the skies dark enough so that they can use all of their tools efficiently to kind of carry on.
But does it make a difference here in Little Vermont?
Yeah, it does. So here's what's really cool is a number of cities across the country have adopted this Lights Out campaign. There are all these really great new resources out there about design around bird-friendly buildings. And we can do that here, too. I remember a number of years ago, a man contacted me because he had a Nashville warbler that had flown into the sliding glass door that he had at night. And it turns out he would leave his porch light on at night. And that was just, it was just enough to break up whatever that bird was using to be able to move through that area. Vermont isn't along like a major migration pathway. Most of the time during the spring, birds are migrating through the central part of the United States. So cities like Chicago and Dallas are ones where we see a lot more problems with collisions and birds getting thrown off by lights. But even here in our own smaller cities, if we think about it, birds are migrating up Lake Champlain and up the Connecticut River. So if we can turn off lights at night, keep those exterior lights off when we can, or switch them over to like motion sensitive ones, that's what I have at my house. So that if I pull in my driveway and I get out of my car, the light comes on while I get out of my car. All my lights are pointed downward too. So if we can design lights where the light isn't spilling out a lot from the sides or the light isn't pouring upward, then we'll be creating less of an impact on birds.
I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. The honking has started again for me. And no, it's not some weird strain of tinnitus related to cars. It's the call of the Canada geese returning. And the sound is lovely. And once the honking starts, you know it's time for us to talk with bird diva Bridget Butler. Let's talk to Craig, who's calling from South Burlington. Hi there, Craig. Go right ahead.
Hello, Rick. Hello, Bridget. Thanks for the show. I have a question. My wife, Muffy, and I have gotten into birding a little bit more, backyard and some other travel work. And as we research with the applications on our phone or the books in describing a bird refer to a song and a call. Mm. And I'm wondering about the differences between those. What are they doing and saying, or why are they using one call or a song in a particular situation?
Awesome. So hi, you guys, Craig and Muffy, come out on some trips with me. So it's great to hear from you. So songs and calls, this is really great because this is something that's kind of fun to start to break down, especially during this time of year, and pay attention to as birds are starting to like set up their territories and find mates. So from this great book called What the Robin Knows by John Young, he describes something called the five voices. And there are ways to kind of break down the things that you hear from birds and kind of attach what the purpose is of those. So there are two songs. There's a song that is used for territory and a song that's used for mating. Sometimes those songs are the same thing. So if we take black-capped chickadee, for example, they sing, "Hey, sweetie." So it's almost, it's three notes, and it descends, and that's the song that they use to both say to other male chickadees, "This is my space," and to attract a mate. So songs tend to be longer.
You had me at "Hey, sweetie."
I know, "Hey, sweetie," and if you put the right inflection on it, you might attract a mate a little faster. Rick, you're making me blush. So the song, it tends to be more melodious and pretty. So that's the longer thing. Calls tend to be shorter, and there are a whole bunch of different types of calls, which is why learning in birding never stops, because there's just so much depth to it. So songs, territory, and mating, calls can be for a number of things, and the major ones are to stay in contact with one another. So when you hear a chickadee going chickadee-dee-dee, and the other one goes
chickadee-dee-dee.
Okay, so we're going to try that again. I'm going to go chickadee-dee-dee.
Chickadee-dee-dee.
So that's those two chickadees staying in touch
slow
with
bird.
Another. That's all right. This is learning. It's good. So they say chickadee back and forth to each other to stay in touch. So the other call, that's contact. Another call is when you're a baby and you're really, really hungry. This tends to be in a more intense, incessant song. And you are going to hear this later in the summertime. So in June, around June and July is when you're going to start to hear that. You'll recognize it when you hear it. And if you have kids, it's like when they get off the bus and they come into the house and they're like, "Cheese stick, I just want a cheese stick. What is there to eat?" You know, it's intense and it's fairly loud. So those are the first four. So we have song for mating, song for territory, a call to stay in touch, a call to ask for food. And then the fifth one is a really fun one to pay attention to. That's the alarm call.
Oh.
So chickadees, when they sense danger, they go into a harsher chickadee and they add more D's to it. Sometimes they'll totally drop the chick and just hit the D really hard. So it's like D, 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 D. Dee 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 dee, and you'll get a whole bunch of them going back and forth together. So if the call is short and sharp and intense, like you can feel it, that's when you want to look around for a predator or somebody that's like slinking along the ground that might be coming in, like a weasel or a cat or, you know, a fox, something like that. Or if the birds are focused on whatever is above them, you start to notice their body language and the birds are going dee, 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 and they've pushed downward. There's an aerial predator. So that hawk that you were talking about might be the alarm causer. So songs and calls are really great to pay attention to. I had this wonderful experience at the bus stop the other day with my kids where I was hearing the chickadees do the chickadee, dee, dee thing. And then they switched to the "Hey, sweetie." And I was like, okay. And I look up and there's a pair. And then it dropped into this other call that I wasn't totally familiar with. And as I looked up, one bird was sitting next to the other. These are both chickadees. And one of them is doing this crazy wing flutter, just like super intense, close to the body wing flutter.
Should I be doing that now too?
You can do that too, right? And they're all puffed up. And the other one comes over and touches beaks with the other chickadee. And I was like, oh, I just saw something there. I didn't know what it was, but I had this great moment, this great question, and the call cued me in to look and pay attention to the behavior. When I got home, I pulled open some of my books. I have this great set of books that are the Stokes Guide to Bird Behaviors. I brought one today. And they do profiles of all the different birds, and they show you in pictures some of these different things. So I'm flipping through the book, and I look up courtship, and it turns out that chickadees pair bond through feeding each other, and they'll even fake feed each other. And to go beyond that, I figured out who was the male and the female by who was doing the wing quivering. So the wing quiver was the female, and the one coming over to do the feeding was the male. And when that happens, you know you're getting close to the time when they are going to like build a nest together and start to have young.
So I was wing quivering over here like a female bird.
There you go.
I?
Look out.
Let's talk to Anne. She's calling us from St. Albans. Hi, Anne. Talk to us. What do you got?
Good morning, Rick, or good afternoon, and good afternoon, Bridget.
Hey.
I'm calling because my oldest daughter and I saw our first red-winged blackbirds of the year this morning, and I wanted to find out who else is returning soon to Franklin County, and also who might be passing through sometime soon. I'm not super familiar with migratory birds in Vermont, so that's why I'm calling to ask.
Yeah. So there is a great, and I think I know who this is. Hi, Anne. Yay. Thanks for calling in. There is a great way to get some of this information through eBird online. So what you want to do is you go to Vermont eBird. That will pop up for you. And across the top, you'll see something that says Explore. And what they have a little bit down below is they have these little histograms for birds. And what they do with all the data from Vermont is for an individual bird, they create like a year-long calendar by month, which each of the weeks. And there are these nice little colored blocks. Now, the bigger the colored block is, the more reports of that bird during that particular week. So you can actually look up different birds and figure out, are they going to be coming back right now? Because they'll be blank. That histogram will be blank, like, you know, from November through February or whatever, and then it'll start to pick up. And you'll see that dark green throughout the rest of the year because they're breeding here. So let's see. My favorites to look for when it's like signs of spring, red-winged blackbird is definitely one. Turkey vulture is another one. I also get excited when people start reporting American woodcocks. And so those are like the early spring birds that to me say, wow, it's time. Red-winged blackbirds can show up as early as the last week in February, which is really pretty cool. Okay, birds I'm excited about showing up soon, like today. I had my first osprey that I saw on my way down here. And yesterday I was out and about exploring at Mill River Natural Area up in the Georgia area. And I had my first warbler of the year. Warblers tend to kind of start to come through in May. Like our peak weekends and excitement for birders tends to be like mid-May. But there are some of those neotropical migrants, the ones that are hanging out in Central and South America during the winter, that are starting to arrive now. And I saw, Rick, I saw Butterbutt.
Oh, yeah.
Yellow-rumped warbler. And I was like doing a happy dance in the woods all by myself.
I love that so much. Well, you've been advocating for something over the last few years called slow birding. So talk a little bit about what that is.
Yeah. So this kind of came out of, you know, I'm a mom now. I have three kids. And what happened was it changed my ability to go out and bird. And I was feeling like a lot of pressure to continue birding and to continue listing and making sure I was hitting all the hot spots and going where the unique birds were. And I just couldn't do it anymore. And then the other piece that came into play was in meeting all these different people through the programs that I do, no one person learns birds the same way. And it seems like birding culture says this is how we learn birds and this is what you need to enjoy about birds. And I was like, nah, because there's so much else there. And I started to slow down and really start to think about, like, what's right outside my door? I started doing a sit-spot practice, which also comes from that book, What the Robin Knows, and with some of the work that I've done with the White Pine Program out of Maine, and really started to get into bird language and paying attention to those five voices, because then they cue you into behavior, and they cue you into other things happening on the landscape. So when a bird alarms, it's telling you that something is going on. And when you can watch for that thing, that opens up so much more to things like fox and weasels and tracking and weather. And I was like, wow, there's a lot here. So I started to design some programming around this to really kind of embrace people where they're at, get them to slow down and not feel the pressure to chase a bird, to list, to have the best bird list or the longest bird list, and really truly get to not only know the bird, but connect with the landscape as well.
Let's take another call. Dylan is calling from Pomfret. Dylan, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I grew up on the North Shore of Massachusetts and used to see great blue herons all the time at the ocean shores. And mm-hmm. I was surprised when I moved to Pomfret, just outside of Woodstock, that I see a great blue heron at least once a year fly right over the upper valley heading north. I've also seen them in pairs, and I one time saw three together. And I was wondering where exactly they're headed and what their migration pattern is like. And yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, awesome question. I like that compare, like starting to think about, I'm like North Shore. Okay, I remember because I used to work for Mass Audubon. I got to travel all around the state. What's that habitat like there? And what's the comparison to what you're seeing where you are in Pomfret? So the great blue herons are probably looking for like a wetland complex. So wetlands near open water. But then they also, in terms of nesting, they need trees to nest in. And we don't really think of great blue herons as sitting up in trees, but they do. So some of the spots that you can go to see herons nesting include off of the sandbar, the causeway there, also at the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge. So really the herons, as they move through and they disperse across Vermont, they're going to look for places that are going to have all of those different types of components so that they can do what they need to do and make more herons. Yesterday, I was along the shores of Lake Champlain where the Mill River dumps out into the lake. And the rest of the lake is frozen, but that spot right in front of the mouth of the river was all open water. And I had 8 great blue herons all in that one spot. So this time of year is a really interesting time of year to see where these birds are staging. As the water starts to open up, like we get to that ice out stage, we're going to see them congregated in different areas, and then they're going to disperse where they can find that wetland and forest complex to be able to nest and raise their young.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Bird diva Bridget Butler is here today, and we're talking about the spring bird migration. Maria wrote to us. She said, I love the show today, especially the chickadee calls.
Yes.
I have a bird feeder and enjoy it tremendously when I refill it and hear what seems to be the call to other chickadees to come and get it. Sometimes they will even land on the bird feeder as I'm refilling. Chickadees have got to be, hands down, my favorite bird.
Nice.
And let's take a call from Scott, who's calling from Colchester. Hi, Scott. Go right ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Great.
Good.
I got a question. Excellent. My question is, I'm having troubles figuring out a hawk that I've seen. I saw him last year, and I would have normally guessed it was a red-tailed hawk, but I've got a close enough look that I believe it's not, unless it's some kind of juvenile form. I believe it's a northern harrier.
Yeah.
But it's supposed to... Yeah, I'm not quite so sure on how to differentiate between northern harrier and red-shouldered, especially from a soaring perspective. So I don't know if I really can from just a silhouette.
From a silhouette.
I'm getting, there's the diagonal, or I'm sorry, not the diagonal, but there's the perpendicular lines on the tail, which is telling me either harrier or red-shouldered.
Mm-hmm.
But that I can't count them, and I can't see really their thickness. I just know there's some horizontalness on the tail.
Any other way to tell?
Yeah, so here's where I'm going to make this pitch, Scott.
Right.
So plumage will trip you up every single time. So trying to look at colors and things like that, I feel like because they change so much in a bird, that's one of the downfalls of the way that we've traditionally learned how to bird, by hooking into the color. And it's a natural thing. Like, we see these birds, we start to notice the patterns and things like that. Scott did mention silhouette. And so silhouette is one of the key things that you can use, especially with hawks, to be able to identify them. But it takes looking a lot. And it takes looking at a lot of hawks. And I still struggle with hawks. Hawks are really hard. So one of the things that I'm trying to shift in the way that I'm cueing my brain in to look at a bird is to look at the things that aren't going to change. So things like the shape of the wing when they are soaring in flight. I like to start to compare proportions. So if you take the length of the body of the bird and compare the body to the tail and the body to how much the head sticks out against the leading edge of the wing. So things that aren't going to change, sometimes once you get those cemented into your brain, when you see them, you will know them and you will key in with that. So off the top of my head, I can't tell you how to tell the difference between a red-shouldered and a harrier, but I can tell you that their habitats are very, very different. So harriers are going to cruise nice open fields that are near woodlands. They tend to soar down low over the top of the field. And red-shouldered hawks tend to be forest hawks. So they're going to be in, Woodside Park, that's right near here, is a great place for the red-shouldered hawk. So habitat can be a big clue as well that you want to hook into. And that is also something that is not going to change. So for me, then, if you really want to go into the plumages, one of the things that I like to look at with the harrier as well is that there's like a little rump patch on that bird right at the base of the body, at the base of the tail. And sometimes when the bird is flying away, if I see that little square rump patch and I'm in the right habitat, then I know it's harrier. The red-shouldered hawk isn't going to have that. So here's what I would encourage you to do. I would encourage you to try two things. One is see if you can get a copy of Richard Crossley's ID book, which is a really interesting way of studying birds. He makes plates that are a mashup of birds with photographs of them in all different types of positions and distances from you, the viewer, on the page. And the whole backdrop is the habitat that the bird is in. So as your brain is synthesizing the information that it's looking at, it's putting some context to where that bird lives and the way that it holds its body as well. And then I would also encourage you to get one of the guides on hawks. There's a couple of apps out there that are through Hawkwatch International that are really helpful as well. And of course, cruise eBird, look up a bunch of different hawks and see where other people are beginning to see them, and maybe that can help you out as well.
Now, Bridget, you've been collaborating with the Vermont Center for Eco Studies on something that could match landowners with birders interested in observing on their property. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is really exciting. This is like new program here. It's kind of like Match.com for like birders and landowners. So it's called Birder Broker. And the Vermont Center for Eco Studies and I have set up this place where we can kind of match landowners who are interested in learning about birds on their property with experienced birders who know how to use eBird. So what's really kind of fascinating about a lot of the bird conservation work that's being done across the state and across the region is that when we work with landowners, we're giving them all these great management tips and techniques. We're helping them find funding to be able to do that. And then one of the pieces that we're missing is it working? And do we know that we're keeping birds on the landscape, or we're increasing the nesting success, or whatnot? And one of the ideas through all the work that I've done was, let's just train the landowners to ID the birds. And the problem with that is it's a really a steep learning curve when it comes down to it, especially if you're asking people to learn different types of warblers or just any bird that's up in the canopy. They're tough to see. They're tough to learn. But we have all these birders in the state that are passionate, that know how to use eBird, and also love to bird in spots that aren't on the beaten path. So right now, landowners in the state, 80% of the forested landscape in the state of Vermont is privately owned, and we don't have a lot of data on those private lands. So by using Birder Broker, what we're hoping to do is get landowners to create a little profile of themselves. They're going to send that to us. Birders do the same thing, say where they would like to bird. And then we will match them up. And the landowner will contact the birder. They get together. They decide where they want to bird on the property. The birder, we ask the birders to come out three times during June and July. upload their information of the birds that they see onto eBird and then share that eBird list with the landowner so the landowner can use it with their forester or when they're managing their grasslands for birds. So this is launching today. And
nice.
We hope that you will go to Birder Broker on the Vermont Center for Eco Studies website. You can find a link to it as well at my website at birddiva.com. We're looking for landowners who want to welcome birders onto their property. We'll help match you up and we'll add to our knowledge about birds across the state.
Oh, that's so great. All right, let's see if we can get another call or two in here. Let's go to Woodstock, and Carol is calling us now. Carol, how are you?
Hi. Hi, Bridget.
Hey.
I'm so glad you're on the air. I love your show.
Thanks.
I love it when you come on. My question, I'm looking at a little junco, a couple of juncos in my yard right now, but this is the first appearance.
Yeah.
And my question, too, is last year, all I had at my feeders were juncos.
Mm.
There were millions of juncos and hardly any, I don't even think I had one chickadee.
Wow.
This year, all I have is chickadees, and there wasn't one junco all winter long until today.
Until today. So, yeah, and I'm hearing this from a lot of people. It's really interesting because I've had juncos at my feeder all winter long. So one of the things I would ask is, where are you? And where are you in elevation as well? So juncos tend to breed in a higher elevation in some of our woodlands and forests than where they hang out during the winter. I live in St. Albans, you know, just along near where Lake Champlain is. We're in the lowlands. And so the juncos are going to move down into the lowlands where it's easier to find food during the wintertime. This winter is a little funky because of the snow cover again. So it's shifted birds and different ways. And my friends that live up in the mountains along the Cold Hollow Range are now saying, oh, I'm starting to get juncos back into my feeder. So there's a little bit of this seasonal shift that's starting to happen as they start to move up into their breeding grounds. But then it's also influenced by snow cover as well.
Well, let's go up into the mountains of Ripton and talk to Bonnie. Hi, Bonnie. Thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I hardly ever get through to you guys, but
it's your lucky day.
Yes, I have a couple of bird questions. First, I've seen the bluebird twice in the last couple of days. But last fall, all my bluebird houses were so old and funky that I took them all down. So I want to know if it's important to get new bluebird houses up before the tree swallows arrive.
Yeah, ideally, yes. And I think for me, I think of nest box season as March. Like, I want to get nest boxes up if they're new ones, and I want to get them cleaned out in March. I don't think you're too late to put a bird box up right now. But yeah, I think getting a bird box up at this point in time is going to be good so the bluebirds can establish their territory. The other thing to try if you have bluebirds fighting with tree swallows is to put two boxes back to back, because often there's like the preferred box that everybody's fighting over. So you just, you know, you turn it into a condominium complex and you put two boxes back to back, and then hopefully they'll each pick a different box.
All right, we are almost out of time, but let's talk a little bit about mating, or specifically courtship behaviors.
Oh, good.
So I know the woodcock has that funky sky dance, but any other really interesting birds doing things out there?
So we talked about the chickadee, right? So anytime you see wing quivering, you want to pay attention. So chickadees, I learned this year, they pair bond feed. Cardinals will do this too. So watch for male and female cardinals kind of feeding each other. Any bird that sidles up next to another bird on a branch, you want to watch what's going to go on there. There may be a little puffing. Oh my gosh, visit the Vermont Edition page for this show, because you have this fabulous photo of a red-winged blackbird doing what we call song spread. So it sings the conch-la-ree and it puffs up and it it shows those red epaulette feathers, and the tail spread goes out. And that is a display that says, I'm here. I have great territory. come and hook up with me.
Wow. What about the grackle? What's the grackle doing?
Oh my gosh. Grackles do all kinds of weird bowing things. So that's another thing to look for. Whenever a bird kind of changes their body position from upright to kind of horizontal with the ground, you want to pay attention to that. There's also another thing called wing drooping, where you almost drop your wings and drag them on the ground. Rick, there's so much out there to notice and explore that I encourage everybody go beyond checking off that list and saying, I know what that is, to really kind of deepening your connection with that bird.
Bridget Butler is indeed the bird diva, and we have a link to her website on today's show page at vpr.org and to Bird Broker. Bridget, it's always a pleasure having you here to enlighten us about birds.
Rick, thank you so much. Thank you all for your calls.